surviving the disease since. However, medicine has now advanced to the stage where HIV and AIDS is, while very serious, a less scary prospect than it was 15 or 20 years ago. That is, if you live in the first world. More than 33 million people across the planet live with HIV, and 22.5 million of those live in sub-Saharan Africa, where the tide is turning a lot more slowly. Today, December the 1st, is World AIDS Day, and joining me in studio, Professor Michael Kelly, Dean of the School of Education at the University of Zambia, and James O'Connor, founding member of Open Heart House, Ireland's largest peer support network of HIV-positive people. Both spoke at the World Day conference in Maynooth yesterday and on Monday. You're both very welcome to the studio. Michael, good morning. You're from Tullamore. You're a Zambian citizen. How did that transition come about?
Well, I was in Zambia from 1955. I went there first. When it became independent, I felt the right thing to do was to be, I'm with the people, I want to stay with the people and work with them. So I said, let's forget Tullamore.
And nailed your colours to the mast.
And I nailed them to the mast, exactly. And I'm very happy that I did so.
Now, you taught there, and ultimately you reached this current high office you enjoy.
Thank you very much. But I've been teaching there. I've been in education all my life out there, the 55 years I've been there. And my education thing brought me very clearly into the AIDS field back in the late 1980s, 1990s, and I got into it from then.
When did it become, you've been in Zambia so long, when did it become apparent to you that there was a really serious problem?
In the late 1980s, mid to late 1980s, and from my perspective as an educator, I was seeing the problem that if our teachers are affected this way, what are we doing to increase the supply of teachers? That was one.
Second, it was absolutely fatal at that point.
At that time, it was a death sentence, so to speak. Secondly, if so many of the young people were dying, young parents, what are we going to do for the orphan children in our schools? And then thirdly, what can we do in our schools to attack and address this problem?
Now, girls and women are disproportionately affected.
Absolutely so. With us, it's about 60% of the infected people are girls and women.
And they are infected by their male partners, one presumes, but a male is not necessarily infected by the female.
A male is less likely to be infected by an infected female than the other way around.
That's why the
death point. There is a biological problem also. As I've said to so many audiences, there's a kind of a design fault.
Okay. That it makes it more likely that a woman will be infected.
More easy, yes. The infected fluid stays in the body, on a bigger part of the body, and the likelihood of abrasions or tears within the body to admit the virus are much stronger in a woman than there are in men.
And that's the reason why women are
well, that's one of the reasons. Yes. There are social reasons, cultural reasons also.
Now, the Pope recently has been talking about condoms. You're a priest. How do you react to the Pope's words, or were you kind of ignoring the status quo before the Pope's remarks anyway?
Oh, no, we're very happy to hear the Pope has at last come over to our side.
I put it that way.
I hope your listeners are not too shocked by that. No, the Pope used a very important word that I have been advocating for a long time, and I'm so happy to hear it. He used the word responsibility. That now, use a condom to protect life, that's a move in a responsible direction, and that we approve of.
So, what we now have is a relative moral scale, if you like. It used to be absolute, where you say, well, to use a condom was wrong, end of story. Now it could be the lesser of two evils.
Oh, well, that it was the lesser of two evils we have accepted for the last...
You have, or the Pope has finally accepted that.
Well, his advisors, I think, were accepting it also, and so many of the cardinals were accepting it, because these are the ones who expressed the opinions, and many of the lesser clergy look over their back to see who the big people are that are saying this, not the small ones.
But on the ground, this has been a fact of life for a long time.
Yeah, it has been a practical thing, but using the condom is one answer to the disease, but it's only part of the answer.
If you like, on the front line of the fight, because there is protection, you may not get infection.
It's much less likely, but condom use apart from religious things involved in it or faith-based things involved in it, is not a popular out for the populations in Zambia or in much of sub-Saharan Africa or in other parts.
It's not a popular
recipe. It's not a popular recipe.
So how has the fight on HIV and AIDS been conducted in Zambia? What other weapons have you got in your arsenal?
Well, there are other weapons such as male circumcision, and that one is now being promoted fairly strongly. Men who are circumcised are up to 60% less likely to get HIV.
No place for the virus to hide and linger.
So to speak, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's one thing. What else?
That one...
I mean, the education you've talked about in schools, how effective is that?
Education in schools, we believe, began to take impact from about the mid or late 1990s onwards. In the early days, the more educated people were much more likely to have HIV than the less educated. But that pattern began to change in the mid-1990s and continues to change.
And what is that? More educated people would more likely have HIV?
Well, more educated people have more money, more mobility, more of them were men, and the three M's are very detrimental in this area.
So the more money you have, the more likely you have to have multiple sexual partners.
Other sexual partners take risky sex and that. But behavior is changing. The message has got home, I believe. And the messages get home better to people who are educated than to people with less education.
And the rate of infection is, I presume, how you would gauge how successful you are.
The rate of new infections. Now, globally, the rate of new infections is falling, not at a very dramatic rate, but it is declining since about 2003-2004. But with us, the rate of infections, annual rate of infections, is still pretty high. We estimate in Zambia that maybe about 120 people die every day of HIV-related illnesses, AIDS-related illnesses, but about 250 become infected. So for everyone who goes out the door, I'm afraid still two more are coming in the door. But our evidence is that there is much less among the younger people than among the older people, and that's where we want to put the focus.
Are there still superstitions about all of this in the way people behave?
Yes, there are. There's still some belief that witchcraft has something to do with this, that I will be able to manage this by going to a herbal, local traditional healer. And that can itself be of some advantage, but it can also be of disadvantage because the traditional remedies, herbs, may interfere with the actual work of the antiretrovirals.
Now, the antiretrovirals, are you getting a cheap supply of these? We remember the Clinton, the global initiative to try and ensure this. Are you getting cheap?
Yes, we are still getting a cheap supply of them, and we have with us about 70% of the people who are in need are on these, but that means there are 30% who are not getting them. And then we have major problems with that. Not just, I don't want to just think in terms of one country, but globally. Currently, about 5.5 million people are on these in the poorer countries. But there's about 9 million people in need who are not getting them. How are we going to pay for those globally? And I'm not thinking just of one country.
The global recession, has that impacted on donor cooperation in this regard?
So the donors are very willing, but the money has flatlined, as we say.
Okay.
It is not going up as rapidly as it was going, so it's not going up rapidly enough to meet the need.
Are you encouraged by what's happening in South Africa? Because we know they were in a state of denial for quite some time.
Oh yes, it is wonderful that the political people there have changed their
own. President Mbeki has a different view to President Zuma, who certainly knows all about sex.
Yeah, he does, yeah. No, and they're very good. Only 2 weeks ago I was with President Zuma's First Lady. Now, I don't know how exactly First Lady means at this foundation, that she was there and participating in a conference and willing to speak about these things, that was very good, I thought.
So, it's a long battle, a long war, and you're winning some battles along the way, but there's still a lot left to be done.
Yeah, I think there's a great deal left to be done because we have to get back down to the roots of some of this. And I think we've been dealing mostly with the symptoms and with the leaves and the branches of the tree, and we're trying to kill the tree that way. We have to kill the roots, and the roots are deep in the culture, the elephant in the room that I don't think we have addressed sufficiently even so far.
Are you talking about in African culture, in Zambian culture?
With the epidemic is unique in every part of the world where it exists. So obviously I'm talking about Zambian culture, but in the cultures of the various peoples who are infected or affected very heavily by this, and similarly in Southeast Asia, there are cultural issues and cultural problems that have got to be dealt with.
James O'Connor, you've been living with HIV since 1991. It must have been a very scary prospect then. We're talking about 20 years ago, before the antiretrovirals were proven.
Yes.
And what was that like at the time?
The day I was diagnosed, my mind was in chaos. We were reading in the media around the recession and chaos right now, but I promise you, what was happening in my mind that day when I was diagnosed with AIDS almost 20 years ago was chaotic, trying to understand, trying to grapple, thinking, oh my God, AIDS that time equals death in Ireland. I also had to try to grapple with around confidentiality, around how would my family accept me, firstly, and then how would society accept me.
Did you know how long you had been positive? Because then you have to look back on your life and say, what have I done?
Yeah. I was 27 years of age then. I estimate I became infected with HIV before I was 21 years of age from unprotected sexual intercourse. From the time 21 to 27 years, I literally put it out of my mind. I felt I could be positive, but I thought, okay, I'm not going for this test because there is no cure, there is no hope. Whereas today, there's a lot of hope for people who get a little test early.
When you had to break the news to your family, how did you feel about actually having to tell them in the first place?
I was living at home. I live in Westmeath, so I'm a neighbour to Father Michael. But I live on a small farm, and I was living with my family. So one by one, I told each member of my family while I was sick in hospital. I'll never forget the look of devastation on my mother's face when I told her. She's about 78 today, so she was born in years when she heard this, you know. My twin brother, he just went green in the face because it was like telling a mirror image of myself that I have AIDS, and we both knew that I was probably going to die. Thank God I didn't.
When did you know that you had the reprieve, that the drugs that were now coming on stream were going to be made available to you and that you could have a great quality of life?
I was put on the new highly active antiretroviral therapies in May of 1996. I was so sick at that time. I was down to 42 kilos. I was hardly able to get out of bed. I was on that medication for about, well over 6 months. It was the 22nd of February, 1997, that I woke up one morning and there was something different with my body. I was actually well. But quality of life improved on one level because I thought, thank God, the medication is working. But the social side, I still had to deal with, what if people find out? And believe me, I've had more pain dealing with the whole psychological, the social issues than I've had with being battered with AIDS-related illnesses for 5, 6, 7 years.
How did you come to Open Heart House?
Really, that morning when I felt well, I thought, okay, I have two choices now. I can continue this mind frame of thinking, okay, what if people find out and I can get back into that bed and die, or I can get off my ass and do something about this. I went to my social worker. She told me about this new organization that was being set up. I went along for a meal one evening, and here were about 10 other people, men and women, and we're just chatting on the couch. The experience that evening was somebody said to me, how did you get over the chest x-ray yesterday in the hospital? And I knew this person from just being at the hospital, and I leaned over to the person and I said, thank God I don't have another chest infection, but the waiting was terrible. And the person leaned over and said to me, I know what it feels like. That part was like winning the lottery.
That was the key.
That was the key. I have found other people who understand.
So how does Open Heart House operate? I mean, who can go to it? How does it meet? How often does it meet? I know it's peer support. People who've been through it are going through it, helping each other.
Yeah. Open Heart House was founded in 1997. We provide a safe, confidential, social environment for anybody who's living with HIV and AIDS. We provide different programs. We have meals, Monday through Thursday. We have complementary therapies. We have counseling, psychotherapy service. We have education service because people are now living. We have outreach services. We work in the prisons and on the street. And anybody, all people need to do is just ring Open Heart House or log on to our website, which is openourhouse.ie.
Openourhouse.ie is a good first step.
Yes.
But do you have a telephone number you can get us?
Our telephone number is 01-830-5000. That's 01-830-5000.
You have to bribe someone to get a good number like that.
830-5000,
very easy one to remember. 01-830-5000 is the number, and openhearthouse.ie. You're having a 24-hour sleepout at College Green starting at just in 15 minutes time.
Yes.
Are you mad or what on a day like today?
Well, we decided we were going to do a visual of the actual isolation that people living with HIV experience. And let's not forget that we have many, many homeless people living with HIV and AIDS who will actually be sleeping out tonight anyway. We're running the sleep out. It is part of a fundraiser because we need much-needed funds. But we're looking at the weather, and our volunteers are all out there. They're saying they're going to do it, but we may have to cut it short depending on what the weather is like.
Because if you're shaking boxes at people and there's no one to shake
there, we need to go home.
So you might well reschedule it for another time when we're all back in normal weather conditions. Look, thank you both very much for coming in. Michael Kelly is Dean of the School of Education at the University of Zambia, and James O'Connor, founding member of Open Heart House. That number again, Dublin, 830-5000, 830-5000, or www.openhearthouse.com.